Hey, hi. Welcome to Someone Else's Movie, the original podcast where an actor, writer, director, or nebulous industry figure gives a little love to a movie they didn't make. I'm Norm Willner, senior film writer for Now Magazine, and this is the other thing I do. My guest this week is actor-turned-filmmaker Amy Jo Johnson, who you may know from her roles in Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, Felicity, Flashpoint, and Covert Affairs. She's also written and directed two feature films, The Space Between, which starred Michael Cram and Julia Sarah Stone, and Tammy's Always Dying, a dramedy starring Anastasia Phillips as a young woman coping with her especially demanding mother, who's played by Felicity Huffman. It premiered at TIFF last September, and it arrives on VOD across North America this Friday, May 1st. You should watch it. Amy Jo picked Captain Fantastic, the 2016 directorial debut of the actor Matt Ross, starring Viggo Mortensen as Ben, an unconventional man who's raised six children with his wife in a remote cabin in Washington State. When she dies and her family insists on holding a conventional service for her in New Mexico, Ben piles the kids into a school bus to crash the funeral. It's an eccentric, rambling kind of picture, a mashup of road movie and character study anchored by some terrific performances, not the least of which is Mortensen's. It just had a slightly misleading title. But I'll let Amy Jo explain that. This is Someone Else's Movie.
You know, I saw Captain Fantastic, when did it come out? 3 years ago? 4 years ago?
2016.
I went to go to the Fox Theater, which is a little theater down the street. And I saw the title and I was like, oh, I don't want to go see a superhero movie. Like, that's not my thing. But then I looked at the trailer and I was like, oh, what is this? So I went by myself and I sat in that theater. And at the end, I couldn't get out of my seat. I was sobbing so much.
Wow.
Yeah, it really struck a chord with me. I found it so beautiful. And I actually just, I picked this movie because I just rewatched it last week and it did the same exact thing it did the first time.
Oh, that's amazing. I love anything that gets people to respond on that level. I did not have quite the same connection to it. I liked it. And I was impressed with the kind of the shagginess of it and the fact that it has room for all the characters. And I the fact that it's directed by an actor or someone who I primarily identify as an actor, Matt Ross.
And his first feature.
That really surprised me. The textures of it and the feel that you're actually seeing a real family, even though these people clearly, you know, even physically, they don't look like each other, which is really interesting. There's just this ramshackle collection of characters who are bouncing off one another.
I didn't see it that way at all.
But
when I saw it last week and I had the same reaction, I was like, what is happening? I was sobbing after the movie. An hour later, I was talking about my favorite scene and I still went into this really like cathartic cry. And I think the connection I have to the film is that I lost my mom to cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Almost 20 years ago. But the scene on the bus when all the kids are just surrounding the mom, oh, it's just so beautiful. And then when they go to the side of the cliff and they start singing Sweet Child of Mine while they're burning the mom, while they're cremating her, and that like song and that rendition of it, and then they flush her down the toilet, it's so moving to me. Something about it is just so, so deeply beautiful.
I mean, I remember that scene vividly. I did not have the same reaction. I don't have that connection. But it is, it's fascinating because it feels anthropological almost to me. Like you're watching a culture work itself out and a ritual that you're not part of.
Yeah. Well, the other thing too is I grew up in a religious cult.
Okay.
And so that's another connection I have with the film is that, you know, this wasn't a religious cult, but it was very cult-like.
Yeah.
He had this cult-like mentality and his ego gets in the way of his love for his children. And when she falls off the roof and he realizes this, that last scene in the movie when he's sitting at the kitchen table and these kids who have always been homeschooled are suddenly having to go get on a bus, but they're doing it quite happily. Just the look on his face, I don't know, that really moved me a lot, that his growth, that character's arc is huge.
Yeah, it's I kind of want to know more about the cult thing, but
it was a religious cult. It was a born again Christian cult, which okay. I don't necessarily think born again Christians are all in cult, but this specific place was. And my mom, when I was 15, like escaped from it with about 20 other families.
Wow.
Where escaped emotionally, I would say, because I didn't grow up physically living in the cult. We were non-residents, and we would go to the community on the weekends and then in the summer during the week. Anyway, so, and she left like overnight, and it was like the rug being pulled out from underneath me in this crazy way. But I think with Captain Fantastic, just watching his journey and the struggle, because I think any cult leader, it's the ego, right, that just takes over of something that may have been in its purest form might have been like an actual good intention.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I want to believe that's how they all start out with the best of intentions. And yeah. And to your own life, there's this fascination in the film as well that realizes that every child grows up thinking they're normal, right? Like their experience is how everyone experiences things. And
it's all relative.
And how, yeah. And how you're, if you're sheltered from the world and, you know, my favorite contradiction in this movie is that he's feeding these kids a diet of Noam Chomsky and knife skills, that both of those are equally valid.
Yeah.
And Mortensen manages to communicate an integrity behind both of those things, where I don't think he's abusing the kids, although that's, I think we're invited to see it from the outside perspective a number of times, but there's just this sense of this pure intention behind it, this purity of intention, yeah. where he is removing himself from the world for the sake of this family.
Yeah.
And not understanding how much damage he's doing potentially to the kids.
Until the moment when she falls off that roof.
Right, yeah, until he's confronted with it. I think
it's like the first moment where he's like, oh, like if these kids are going to be a part of society, like they're going to have, he's going to have to change his ways. I just want to say like something that you just said. I wonder, you know, this whole pandemic and all this stuff that's happening, but children, like I have an 11-year-old, mm-hmm. are probably more adaptable to this situation right now than we are, because again, it's also, you know, relative of what we have as our norm.
Yeah. Know? Yeah. A friend of mine was actually, we were just Skyping with her last night, and she said that she has 3 kids. They're all like kids. They're all, I think the oldest is 7. And she said that in the last couple of months, they've seen sides of her that wouldn't have been visible otherwise. Maybe it's stress, maybe it's grace, maybe it's a mixture of everything. But yeah, kids everywhere are adapting to this idea that their parents are living with low-level panic all the time and rolling with it, because that's what we do for children. I mean, I don't have kids, and I would definitely be messing them up if I was trying to parent them at this point. Oh, no, I know who I am. I would not be handling this well. But yeah, it's unimaginable that an entire generation is going to be shaped like by this slow motion crisis. You know, 9/11 is a thing that everybody has imprinted on them. For me, it's the Challenger when I was a teenager.
Oh, that was too. I remember that day. Yeah. I was in class watching it.
Yeah. And then we went home stunned. We were all just kind of remember. Like, yeah. And it was in Ontario, it was the middle of the day. It was like 11:30 or something. So the day was half over already. And it's just like lunch just turned into go home. There's nothing else anyone can do. We were all in this state of shock.
Do you remember the 2 weeks leading up or the month leading up? Like, I think at least 6 teachers in my school had applied for that. It was such a big deal. Oh my God.
Yeah. I remember that the science teachers were all like one of our own. They were all amped up for it. And then, yeah, but it happened in 3 seconds, right? Like it just, the hammer came down, and that's our generational trauma. And then these kids now are just going to remember that time where we all stayed home and everybody freaked out. And hopefully, like if we get through it, it'll be because we all stayed home and nothing happened.
Did you ever see the TV show Euphoria? I only watched one episode.
It's the HBO series. No, I haven't seen it.
Yeah. But the opening of that show talks about all the kids that were conceived during 9/11. And their parents had so much stress and anxiety that they are now teenagers in Euphoria. And they, all the issues that they have come from post-traumatic stress of being in the womb during that time, which I find interesting. So fascinating.
So like as fetuses, they were being squeezed all the time.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. It's just like in the opening thing, it says something, but it's true. Kids who were born, you know, after 9/11, there's a different, the world changed.
Yeah. I mean, they've grown up in an America that's constantly at war and under, you know, security theater and panic and everything else there. That's right. There's the pre-Homeland Security generation and the post.
Yeah.
Wow. And then, but to get back to Captain Fantastic, they have their own status of stasis, right? Because they've never left the woods. They've been raised in completely different conditions of a hermetic seal. It's just that the security state is their father.
Yeah.
And presumably their mother, who, like, it's implied she was on his side, right? That she was a believer as much as he was.
She had suffered from depression and postpartum depression. And
Yeah. And you kind of almost, I wanted to grab a larger metaphor about this being his idea of protecting everyone, her and the kids, and taking them to the places where they couldn't be encroached upon or invaded or bothered, as though that would save her. And it feels altruistic. This is what I mean about him feeling pure of intention. If you look at it from the outside, it's deeply unhealthy and psychologically wrong, but they all pull together inside this space that they've created for themselves, right? They've built their oasis.
And even at the end of the movie, you could tell that they were all going to be okay, you know, being, you know, put back into society, but still stay together as a family, probably a lot smarter than most of the other kids that they'd now be going to school with.
Yeah. I kind of want to watch that movie. I would love to see what happens next.
Yeah, the sequel. Yeah, totally. Yeah. And the older son, who's such a fantastic actor, that guy who was in 19...
George McKay, right? He's a little... I think he'd be too busy for the thing now, but he's in everything. He was in... Yeah. I knew him from Pride, and all of a sudden he's in 1917, and he was in something else fairly recently. I have to admit, I'm not that crazy about him. I think this is the film I like him the most in. He has this sort of open, stunned expression as a default. Like, his resting face is a little gawky. And it works here. It works so well.
He's so good in that 1917, though. Wow. Yeah,
it's mime acting. He's jumping this way and moving that way. And I don't know. I think it's less about performance than it is about him being treated as a special effect by the film. I don't blame him for it. I think it's just how he's used. But here, he's... I was looking up the interview I did with Mortensen when the film came out, and he had talked about how he ended up kind of accidentally being part of the casting process. He read with the last two candidates for each of the kids' roles.
Oh, that's great.
And I have it right here because I thought this was great. He said it was like free rehearsals. They had a couple of weeks once they cast the kids, they had a couple of weeks where we worked on the things we had to do together in the movie. We played a lot of music together, improvising and trying to get familiar. And it's a nonverbal interaction that puts a premium on listening. And he says it's by the end of the process, they knew each other really, really well.
That's so cool. You got to interview him about the movie. He's so good in this movie.
Yeah. I'm not surprised he picked this part. It's so him. Mortensen is this fascinating polymath. You know, he owns an art gallery. He's a Montreal Canadiens fan. Like, he's an insane Habs fan. I know I've told this story on the podcast before, but every time he comes to TIFF, he brings a giant Canadiens flag and just stands around with it to piss people off, which I think is
so weird.
It's so great. I was at the Intercontinental downtown, and I was waiting for an elevator. The doors open, and he was standing there with the flag spread wide inside the elevator with this idiot grin on his face, just because he knows he bumps people.
That's so funny. Because that would,
Yeah, he's delightful. And to watch him play someone so troubled and rigid is different for him, right? Because he's usually, I think his physiology, the shape of his face and the way he holds himself leads people to cast him as heavies. But he's so magnetic and interesting.
Yeah.
That even in something like Green Book, where it's an ostensibly comic performance, he can still find these little moments of severity or hostility and just turn in and turn them on and off on a dime. And he does that here a few times too, when his back gets up, when he's instinctively trying to protect someone. from themselves, often even from their own family.
Yeah, the scenes when he went to, now was it his sister's or was it his sister-in-law's house that they went to?
It's the sister-in-law, right? They go to New Mexico for her funeral. So they're in the bosom of the wife's family.
Okay.
I think. I haven't seen it in a couple of years. I may be misremembering it, but I'm pretty sure that he's the outsider in that home, that he's not, it's not his family.
Okay. Yeah, unless, I couldn't tell fully.
And it's veiled, right? They don't really come out and say anything, which is how family would work, I think.
Yeah.
You know, you're so familiar with people that...
And they're so good, too. Who are those two actors? I'm trying to look them up right now.
Oh.
Who plays the sister and the brother-in-law?
He's so good, it's that guy. Steve Zahn, right? And Steve Zahn and Catherine Hahn.
Yeah.
Yeah. Who are great. And again, they've got comic actors against him playing dramatic roles. So there's this weird unspoken tension of how we expect the actor to behave and how the character plays.
Which I love that when you have these like funny actors that have like these comedic backgrounds and then they play these more serious roles. Because those are the types of films that I like to make, are to take heavy subjects and then find the humor within it. Not to get off topic from Captain Fantastic.
No. It's fine.
But I loved that Barry. Did you see Barry?
Oh, the Bill Hader series.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's so good because it's so funny, but yet it just stays in this tone that is so difficult to master, and it just really does.
Yeah, there's that moment in the last season, I think it was the third episode in, where the last shot of it is just Hader's face turning into a mask, a rage mask, and it's, I know he's an actor, I know he can do anything, but I had never seen him do that before, and it's just terrifying.
Yeah. And Henry Winkler, oh my God, is so brilliant in it. So funny, but so earnest. That's what I love so much. That the funny, the comedians that can be, but yet be earnest.
Yeah. It's like there are well-meaning caricatures of narcissists, but you still feel the humanity underneath it. It cracks, especially with Winkler in the most recent season after his, he falls in love and she's murdered and he has to spend the entire season dealing with that loss in a way he's not equipped to deal with it, right? Like, that's the joke of it. It's that he doesn't know how to handle this profound emotion that he's experiencing, even though he's an acting teacher and he's supposed to be able to help people channel these deep, deep feelings. It's amazing. And and you have, again, to come back to this, you have Mortensen playing someone who is struggling with the same thing. Like, he's not ready to lose his wife. His kids weren't ready to lose their mother. And he has to find a way to steer them all through this, even though they're doing the one thing that no one wants them to do, which is crash the funeral. And you can see the way he justifies those choices to himself, selfishly, but convinced that he's altruistic, convinced that he's doing it for the health of the family.
Mm-hmm.
I assume that's where the Oscar nomination came from. It's just that's the conflict that everybody can respond to. But it's like, he never says it. It's never declared. The kids don't understand how to bring it up. It just floats. And again, coming from a first-time director who mostly doesn't work behind the camera, I was staggered by that.
Yeah, it was great. He had a veteran DP with him, right?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I hope that sounds right.
Stefan something. Anyway, visually, the movie is also incredible. Like, it's stunning.
Yeah, it's beautiful. It's lush.
And the colors it was like eye candy to me. I loved it. I loved all the colors and the, I don't know. I loved it so much.
Yeah, and you just stumbled into it. That's so.
I did.
That's so great.
Like, I do not want to watch a superhero movie, and but it wasn't.
It does seem kind of self-defeating to call your movie Captain Anything at this point in time. It just right guarantees now, if you search for it, you're only going to see Marvel movies.
Yeah.
But yeah, maybe that's it. That's just how you hook people in. That's how you trick them into it.
But for me, I wasn't going to go.
Right. Yeah. you know, it's like people who are being told now to put an A at the beginning of their movie title so it shows up faster in the rankings. It's just search engine optimization trickery.
But that stuff works.
Yeah, where you, let's see, your films start with an S and a T. So.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
You can't get away with A space between. I guess you could do A space between this. But yeah, so is this the kind of movie that you could see yourself making, or is it so... Is it the thing that you embrace because it's so unlike anything you would do?
Oh, no, I think it's right up my alley. Of like one of my favorite movies from when I was like in my early 20s was Harold and Maude.
Oh, yeah.
And it reminds me colorfully, and there's a somewhat of a similarity within the framing and the way it's shot. I don't know. It has something to it that feels, that reminds me of that a little bit. And that's what inspired me the most was Harold and Maude, I think.
Yeah, there's a sort of gentle pastoral quality to the music as well.
That yeah, maybe which is feels all Cat like Stevens in Harold and Maude. I think it's also the big, there's a lot of wide shots and a lot of landscapes, and it's very, Harold and Maude has that too.
Yeah. So
yeah,
that's
and
true.
My first feature, The Space Between, I think if you ever have a chance to see it, I was inspired by that.
It's true. Now that I'm thinking about it, there are a lot of long shots of people just walking on streets with the whole world around them rather than just close up, right? Which movie are you talking about? The Space Between. Isn't it? I mean, I'm vivid, unless I'm misremembering. Aren't there like, I'm just remembering long scenes of Julie Sarah Stone walking down the middle of a road.
Yeah, like a big, like an, but, yeah. But when you said all... street, it sounded like a city street. But that was very rural.
Right.
Like,
yes.
Yeah, the desert almost, yeah.
Sorry, I'm a city kid. They're all streets to me. but you're aware of her environment. The frame is big enough to contain it rather than just close up on her.
And vehicles. All three movies deal with a lot of vehicles.
Okay,
that's true. With Harold and Maude, it's the motorcycle and... they think they steal a truck too, but that bus in Captain Fantastic is a character in itself. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a great signifier too of the era that they think they're in. Cause that, you know, that's not a bus. It is a bus from the past, but they're not old enough. The kids aren't anyway to have been part of that. Mortensen's always old. I'm always surprised to find out how old he really is. He's almost 60, or maybe he is 60 now.
Wow.
He's older than I think every time. And he could credibly have been around for that, but the kids are so young. You know, I think the oldest is he supposed to be 19? Because they're all...
Yeah, he's 18. Or he 18. Just gets into all those universities. Right,
right. Because they're all born after, well, the late...
17, 18.
Yeah, so the late 90s at the very earliest. And it's this weird contradiction of this, again, like the sense that they're removed from time just by their, not just their lifestyle, but their aesthetics and their ideology is so 70s and 80s, and these kids never knew any of that. They were all born after cell phones, and still
right.
They're
but
like...
But that is all they know, because that's all they were taught.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The culture shock from that is going to be incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to see the sequel. I do.
I think it would be great, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think Matt has... directed another feature.
No, not as far as I know. I'm not even sure he's directed anything.
I thought he did a fantastic job.
Yeah, it's a level of sensitivity and again, it's how can I put this without sounding insulting? A lot of actors, when they direct actory movies, like very focused on one performance or one thing, because it reflects a certain tunnel vision maybe that you need to do when you're a performer. And he sees everybody. He lets every character have, even Catherine Hahn and Steve Zahn have moments where they're not just cardboard villains. They're allowed to be genuinely concerned and empathetic for a second.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure.
And while we were talking, I looked it up and Matt Ross has directed two episodes of Silicon Valley since. And apparently he's working on a feature, but...
Yeah, I saw that. I was like, oh, good. He's working on a feature. Good.
Yeah.
It's hard to get a feature funded.
I know. We were trying to figure this out. I did an episode of The Big Story where we talked about how the industry is handling this. And I was wondering if maybe all of a sudden those mid-range movies that studios have stopped making will suddenly become appealing as productions in the next, you know, like in the months when this starts back up again, because they don't require thousands of people to work on them in post, right? Maybe there's a possibility of more interest. And theaters might be desperate for something to screen, and they could plug in some of the films that were otherwise just going to go to VOD. It's such a weird...
And they're a lot cheaper to make as well.
Yeah. Right. We're in such a strange space right now. I mean, Tammy's Always Dying was going to have a theatrical release, right? And
it's supposed to come out May 1st theatrically as well. It's still coming out on VOD, which is fantastic. I'm really excited about that. I'm so grateful and happy that we went to TIFF last year, and we didn't wait for South by Southwest or Tribeca or, you know... It was such an incredible experience, and I'm so grateful that, you know, the film got to be celebrated, and it was really amazing for me as a filmmaker to have a film in TIFF, and it, my first film that gets into TIFF. It was so special.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I'm glad people get to see it at all, because that's still a risk, right? Films can disappear after a festival circuit play, but... Yeah, I would have loved to see it with a crowd. Like, there's that weird space now that we are all in where the last time I saw a movie in a theater was, I don't know, 6 weeks ago. And I have no idea when the next opportunity is going to come around. Mm-hmm. And the idea of people finding movies, hundreds of movies are going to be released this way now. And we'll all experience them separately. And it's just such a... I mean, I know people stream movies, right? It's becoming the dominant way to see things, but it still seems so alien to me that a movie can come out and just be alone that way.
Yeah. We are doing a little premiere, a virtual premiere.
Oh, yeah?
I think because of that, like, I just really wanted to figure out a way to sort of celebrate in a similar way, but however, you know, how we can do it right now. So we're doing a Zoom premiere party. My friend Greg Grumberg, who was on Felicity with me, is going to host it with me. And then Joanne Sarazin, the writer, and Anastasia Phillips, who stars in the movie, is going to be there too. And then we have this contest happening, and 50 people are going to win tickets to it, and they're going to all watch the movie, and then we all gather and talk about the film and celebrate it in the best way we can.
Oh, that's nice. When is that happening?
What, May 1st.
May 1st.
On the premiere, yeah.
Okay, so this will come out ahead of that. And how can people enter this contest to win?
Oh, okay. So you have to post a picture onto Instagram of what you would wear to the premiere. And then, just trying to make, you know, something fun for it. And then you tag A to the Double J is my Instagram, and Tammy's Always Dying on Instagram, and then hashtag Tammy's Always Dying and hashtag premiere from here.
Okay.
And then we're gonna, you know, gather up all the submissions and pick the 50 most creative ones and watch the movie and talk about it and celebrate the film coming out.
Well, that's great. That sounds incredibly complicated, but I'm sure it'll be
in
worth
what
it.
Way?
Well, just you're going to get slammed with applications. There's going to be so much to judge.
I don't know. We'll see. The contest was launched yesterday.
Okay. And this is going to go out on Tuesday. So when does it close?
Tuesday night.
Okay. So if you're listening, you have a few hours.
Yeah.
and, you know, be creative. Quickly. Go.
Yeah. Oh, people already have been. As soon as I did a Stage It show. I play piano and sing and I did a show yesterday sort of announcing the rules and talking about it. And right after, I think there's like 10 or 15 posts already.
Nice.
Kind of fun.
Yeah. So what's the most impressive thing you've seen so far? Are people really going for it?
Well, when somebody posted a dog all dressed up, I said be creative as you want. This one person in England, well, this is the kind of the cool thing too, is, it, you know, the movie is coming out in the United States and in Canada. But with this virtual premiere party, we might pick one or two people who aren't in Canada or the United States, which is kind of nice for them. Anyway, he was dressed in some, I don't know what it was, like a Sergeant Pepper costume or something. It was pretty cool.
Nice. Yeah, the concept of the red carpet is going to change radically, I think, in the next year or so, as people just get all this pent-up energy out once we start going back into the world.
Yeah, yeah. When's that going to happen?
I know. It'll be nice. It's and now all these movies are about, you know, you've got a movie where two people are sitting in close quarters in a car and they've been apart and that's not supposed to happen anymore. I was watching, I was writing about the F word recently, and it's like a Toronto that doesn't exist anymore because everybody's going to clubs and bars and restaurants and knitting circles and all of that stuff is just over for the time being. I would be very happy to get back out into the world. I think I miss a latte. I haven't had a latte in forever.
You know? Yeah. I miss going out to dinner too. I was talking to my friend about writing right now and you know, I'm writing something, thank goodness, it's called Somewhere Someone, and it's fictional, but it's about a love story about somebody who was on one of the planes that landed in Gander during 9/11, and she falls in love with a local. So I can continue writing this because it takes place beforehand. Mm-hmm. But people who are writing right now of something that's contemporary, that's like, what do you do? What are you writing? We don't know what the world's going to look like in a year, you know?
Yeah.
Will everybody have masks or, you know, what's going to change?
Yeah, it's like the movies that came out after 9/11 where everyone had to take the World Trade Center out digitally so as not to remind people of reality. Maybe people will want the same escape in a year's time. And we can watch movies about, you know, people trying to set up a bakery or something where it's just completely detached from the way we live now. I'm still watching television regularly, all the shows that were made before this happened and all the movies that are still trickling out. I'm not in a place yet where I'm freaking out about everyone being too close together. Like there's a high school movie coming to Netflix called The Half of It. And it's just people in a small Pacific Northwest town walking around and doing stuff and going to the football game. And I wasn't nostalgic yet, but as I was writing the review, I thought, oh yeah, this is a gone time. Like this is a movie from the before time.
Yeah, well, hopefully everything will find a little bit of normalcy by the end of the year. Did you read that gaslighting article?
No, I'm not sure. Which one?
Just about how, when this is all over, how big businesses are going to want us to go back to normal, and that they're going to want us to, like, believe that this never really even happened.
Yeah.
As much as possible. Anyway,
that's going to be hard to pull off.
Yeah. Because I think a lot of kindness and generosity is coming out of all of this, as well as how awful and hard it is. I think people are being very generous right now.
Yeah, I hope that continues. That would be nice.
We can
see ourselves be better. So, yeah, let's keep that going.
Yeah.
I actually was thinking about, again, the kids in Captain Fantastic on the bus. Imagine them not knowing any of this is happening. What would the movie be like if they emerged from that world into this one?
Yeah. Was it like 2 weeks after everything got shut down and Jared Leto came out of
his retreat.
His silent retreat. And he's like, what's happening?
Yeah. I kind of like that. That's a Black Mirror episode waiting to happen.
Totally. I think it already has, but oh my.
Yeah. So we sort of touched on drawing influences from Harold and Maude, but is there anything in Captain Fantastic that you or yourself have borrowed or lifted or just outright stolen for a project?
No, not necessarily, besides just feeling incredibly inspired after watching the movie and just made me want to go write and make another one.
No, that's nice. I mean, if nothing else, to take that away, it's a pretty nice thing.
Yeah.
My thanks to Amy Jo Johnson, whose new movie Tammy's Always Dying premieres on VOD across North America this Friday, May 1st. Thanks also to Brianna Hurley. She knows what she did. Oh, and if you're listening to this on Tuesday, April 28th, when it dropped, there's still time to get in on that Premiere From Here contest. Get on the Instagram. You can find Amy Jo on Twitter at @AmyJoJohnson, all one word. And you can find Captain Fantastic on Blu-ray and DVD from Universal Pictures in the US and Entertainment One in Canada. It's also available on iTunes and Google Play. As always, you can find me on Twitter at Norm Wilner and elsewhere on the internet at NowToronto.com, where in addition to my occasional film writing, I now host a new podcast, Now What?, in which I interview Torontonians about the weird new normal of self-isolation in COVID-19. You can find it Tuesdays and Fridays in your podcatcher of choice, and you can also find this podcast on Twitter at Semcast, S-E-M-Cast, and on the web at someoneelsesmovie.com. Our theme song is by The Last Year. If you like it, or you like the show in general, say something. Leave a review on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts or wherever you've been listening. Every little bit helps, and come on, it's not like you don't have time. And check out the other shows on the Frequency Podcast Network. I just appeared on a recent episode of The Big Story talking to Jordan Heath Rawlings about a few dozen movies and TV shows I'd recommend as quarantine viewing. You might find that helpful. Thanks for your support, and thanks for listening. Stay inside, watch movies. I'll see you next week.